Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Billy the Brain, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock, here on KKZZ AM 1400, also streaming on the internet at 1400kkzz.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people have to say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is National Public Radio done right, with the emphasis on the right. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is the real world. Our guests will bring us stories from the world outside of Ventura. We also both have important messages to impart. My first guest takes a look at behind the scenes of a drug-addicted world that most of my listeners know nothing about. His searing and detailed portrait of a dying town is the product of years' worth of research. Nick Redding's newest book, Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town, is the story of one small town dealing with the worst drug epidemic in our history. Redding taps into the wider history of the drug in our culture and the forces that fostered its foothold in our society. Nick was born in St. Louis, Missouri, just like Billy the Brain. He received his B.A. in Creative Writing and English Literature from Northwestern University. We won't tell you the year. He also has a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from NYU. He lived and worked in New York City until he came to his senses, moved back to St. Louis. That's where he lives with his wife and his son. Welcome to the show, Nick. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you on board. And so tell me, I'm from St. Louis. Where do you live in St. Louis?
I live in the Central West End.
The Central West End. Billy the Brain grew up in Webster Groves, just to give you an idea.
Oh, okay. Well, I grew up in Chesterfield.
All right. Good for you.
Now called Chester World because it's gotten so big.
I'm coming back in October, so I can't wait to see how the city has changed. You know, it's a funny thing, and we'll get into your book in just a minute, Nick, but you can go away from St. Louis, you can become President of the United States, you can become Supreme Court Justice, whatever, but when people come back to St. Louis, this is a curious thing, you'll always get asked, where did you go to high school?
Yes, you will.
It's unique to no other city in the United States does that. So anyway, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. That's great. Now, your book, Methland, it's about a city, and I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this correctly, Olween, Iowa. It's a rural community. It's about 300 miles from Chicago. Only has 6,000 residents. It's a farming town. And they got smashed with a couple of different things, modernization of agriculture and also the rise of methamphetamine production. How'd you find this little town, and how'd you select to write about it?
You know, I had really the way I got to Olween, and a lot of people were sort of frustrated by this answer, and I hope that you're not one of them, is because I just developed quick and good relationships with the people who I knew would be characters there, I mean, for this book. And I think that, you know, a lot of times people sort of expect the answer to be, well, Olween is, you know, sort of has the worst meth problem, or Olween is the most indicative. And honestly, that is, Olween is very much embodies the different problems that are obvious throughout the Midwest and throughout the small town United States. But really the thing that drew me there was that I would just, you know, as a journalist, you got to have people to write about, and if people won't talk to you, you got to keep moving until you find ones that will. And that's where I found people who would really talk to me.
Well, see, now that's a very pragmatic approach. I like that Midwestern mentality, that Midwestern thinking. That's good. All right, so you dive into what is probably the biggest drug epidemic in this country. Tell me a little bit about the history of methamphetamine.
So it's has a lot longer history than most people recognize. It was first developed. I mean, it's a purely synthetic drug, and it was first synthesized in 1898 in Japan. But the most important part about, you know, talking about the meth epidemic in the United States is that, you know, it gets treated as though what we're seeing now, i.e., you know, from the mid-80s until, you know, right today, is kind of the first meth epidemic. And in fact, it's more like the third in the United States. There was a big one in the 50s, and there was a big one in the 30s. And so it's not a new drug by any means.
Well, now that's interesting and something that I didn't know. So let's go back to the 30s and the 50s. The 50s maybe I could understand because methamphetamine was considered kind of a wonder drug in the 1940s. But tell me about the 30s. How did people start getting involved with methamphetamines in the 30s?
Well, you know, about, let's say, 1933 to 1936, somewhere in there, meth was manufactured by SmithKline, which is still a big pharmaceutical company.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, being produced completely legally, and it was considered to be a cure for something like 27 different ailments that were as different as from like depression to alcoholism to erectile dysfunction, lots of different things. But there developed along with wide-scale use of meth a black market for meth. And that is, so by the end of the 1930s, it was still considered a miracle drug, but there were just reports they were just coming out saying that it had these horribly psychotic side effects. And that was one of the first instances where people started abusing it on the black market.
Okay, got it. So that's when it became. Now, today, it's really become the overwhelming drug of choice. How did it become this country's most popular illegal pharmaceutical?
Well, and there again, if you look at what happened in the 50s and in the 70s, and what happened during World War II, which is that meth was given in enormous amounts to American, British, Japanese, and Nazi servicemen. So you say, well, why would you give meth to American servicemen? Because it's always been a blue-collar drug. It is a drug that allows you to work hard without having to eat, sleep, or drink water. It actually increases your awareness short-term. It increases your ability to concentrate short-term. It's the only drug I can think of that is really a vocational drug as opposed to a recreational one. A minimum dose of meth lasts you 12 hours. You don't have to snort another line every 20 minutes. I mean, you're high for a long time. So, it's an efficient work drug. That's why it became the drug of choice, not just of soldiers, but of long-haul truckers, of auto plant workers, of farm workers. So that, it's still the drug of choice for the American working class because it's cheap, it's long-acting, and it allows you to do the most American thing, which is attempt to supersede class through hard work.
Ah, okay. I can see how that works. Now, let's return back to the city in Iowa, Olean, Iowa, and there's a kind of a central myth in our national culture that there's something fundamentally undiluted, something fundamentally authentic about small towns, and that's implicitly absent from our big cities, that small-town residents are somehow more godly, more hardworking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You went into Iowa and took a look at this town. Would you say that that is true?
No, and I think sorry to be sort of philosophical, but, I mean, life is life, you know, and it's not any easier in Olean, Iowa than it is in Tampa or Ventura or St. Louis or New York. I mean, you have to do the same things, you know, you have to
you have to get a job and hold a job and feed yourself and do all of this stuff, and you're taxed and people get divorced. It's no different in a small town. What's different there is that when something like a drug such as methamphetamine becomes a major part of the economy and has all of these really bad effects culturally and socially and medically, a small town can't absorb the cost of that in the way that San Francisco or New York or Los Angeles can. So there's no treatment facilities. The hospital has a hard time dealing with the meth addicts. The police have a harder time dealing with them. So it's not that small towns are more godly or more real or something. What they are is they're more vulnerable.
Interesting observation. Everybody, we're talking to Nick Redding. He's the author of the book Methland, Death and Life of an American Small Town. We'll be right back with him. And we also have a giveaway today right after these short messages. So stay tuned. Back to Nick Redding, who's the author of the book Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. He went to Iowa, found a small 6,000-resident town in a central farming area, and did some research on the impacts that methamphetamine use has had in the town. And Nick, one of the most fascinating things about your book is the characters. And you said right at the top of the interview the reason that you went to Olwayne, Iowa, was because these are people that would talk to you. So I just want to ask for your some top-of-mind thoughts about some of the different characters in your book. Dr. Clay Halberg.
So, you know, the book essentially follows like almost 4 years in the life of the town, but it also follows 4 years in the life of the town doctor, who is Dr. Clay Halberg, and the mayor and the prosecutor, and then a couple of different meth addicts. And Clay is somebody who, you know, I mean, there's this thing, you being from St. Louis, maybe this affected you or people you know, but there's this idea out here that if you stay where you're from in the middle of the country, it is a form of failure. Like, your job is to leave and go to one of the coasts and become educated and get a good job, and because things like that are harder to come by out here, and they have been for the last 4 years, and that's just the way it is. But Clay is a guy who left town and became a doctor like his father before him, and then he moved home to become that town general practitioner. And in a small town like that, when you're the town GP, you take care of everybody for everything. And Clay had as front row of a seat as you can for what happened when meth came to town, essentially.
And so you kind of chronicle it through his eyes as you're writing the book, right?
Yeah, he's kind of the conscience of the book in some ways, because, you know, he's this guy who essentially succeeded in getting out, and then in his late 20s, after having been through medical school, said, you know, the best thing I could do instead of moving further away from my town and my home is to go home and try and do something positive. I thought that was that made him sort of a remarkable character.
Absolutely, it did. Now, every town, I guess, has its brush with fame, and Olwayne, Iowa is no exception to that. Tom Arnold's sister, Lori, was there, and she was a character in your book. What was her role in the book?
Well, Lori Arnold, as you rightly say, is the sister of the comedian Tom Arnold, and Lori was really pretty much the biggest methamphetamine trafficker and producer ever in the Midwest. I mean, that is known. I mean, that has been caught. In fact, she's been caught and sent to federal prison twice. And if there was anybody who was making and trafficking more methamphetamine from all over the country, then I don't know in that part of in the Midwest. I don't know who it would be.
Mm. Interesting. Now, tell us about Roland Jarvis, another central character in the book.
So Roland is kind of is the one of the addict characters. And when I say character, I mean, you know, it's weird. I mean, these are real people. These are their real, I mean, these are not fictional characters. It's weird to talk about live humans as characters. But anyway, for the purposes of talking about a book, I don't know any other word. So Roland is a lifelong, essentially, methamphetamine addict and also a small-time meth cook who literally blew himself up cooking meth and lost most of his fingers and his nose and the skin on 78% of his body, and managed to live through it somehow, 3 months in the burn unit in Iowa City Hospital. And the minute he came home, the first thing he did was to get high.
Amazing. Amazing how addictive this drug is. And last one I'm going to quiz you on is Nathan Lean, or it might be Nathan Line. I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
Yeah, it's actually Lien.
Lien?
Yeah, it's the Norwegian pronunciation as opposed to German. But Nathan is a little bit like Clay Hallberg. Nathan is the assistant county prosecutor and remains so today. And a much younger man. Nathan's probably about 35 anymore. But he also left home to go to law school and decided, instead of continuing his kind of outward trajectory like most of us from this area of the country had done, that he would turn around and go home. And that's how he took the job of being the assistant Fayette County prosecutor. He grew up on a farm, his parents' still farm, about 475 acres north of town. And, he's another sort of major, his sort of battle about what to do about this thing that has come to his town and kind of destroyed the social fabric. That's a lot of what the book is about.
Interesting. Now, in your book, Methland, and we're talking to Nick Redding, everybody, author of the book Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. In your book, you link methamphetamine use to the growing power of unregulated capitalism that began way back in the 1980s. How do you make that connection, and is this a war on drugs that we're going to be able to win with meth?
Well, the connection that I make is there's two parts of it, and one is that in the era of, Republicans call it deregulation, and then Clinton Democrats call it globalization. As it turns out, those are the two same things, And so, but during the Reagan 80s, there were a couple of major shifts that had to do ultimately with the methamphetamine market and why people were using more of it. And one of those shifts was in the pharmaceutical industry. And the lobbying power of these growing pharmaceutical companies became such that they made it impossible for DEA to regulate the ingredients of cold medicine. So what does that have to do with meth? Well, because meth is made from the same drug the cold medicine is made from. So by protecting the cold medicine industry, you're essentially protecting the meth trafficking industry.
Okay.
And because there's no other drug in the world that's linked one-to-one, no other illicit drug that's linked one-to-one with potentially the world's most lucrative licit drug. That's cold, right? Cocaine comes from coca. There's only one thing you can make from coca. That's cocaine. There's only one thing you can make from poppy. That's heroin. There's two things you can make from pseudoephedrine. You can make cold medicine and methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
So that link is very important. But the other thing that happened at the time in this era of deregulation was that the modern American food industry came into being. And somewhere between 60 and 70% of all American farmers lost their farms. And there was incredible consolidation in the meatpacking industry and the railroad industry, in all of these different aspects of how we make food and how we get it from point A to point B. This killed places like Old One. It absolutely killed them. So the places, so the people who were left living there, had more and more incentive to go into small-time meth production at the very point at which it was much easier for them to go into that business, because it was easier for them to get the precursor drugs. And all that put together was very difficult on Old Wine. That's what brought meth there the way it is today.
That's an interesting convergence of a bunch of unrelated factors. We're talking to Nick Redding, everybody, author of the book Methland. Nick, as I was reading the book, I saw some similarities between meth manufacturing and use in the 21st century in old wine and moonshine in the early 20th century in the South. Are there any similarities, or was that just me drawing some false conclusions?
No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think there are some. I mean, there were a lot of similarities between these two eras in terms of rural economies. I mean, you know, one of the last times that, for instance, the meatpacking industry became so incredibly highly centralized, much to the detriment of its workers. And what I mean by that is that, you know, back in 1987, Oldwine had a meatpacking plant that employed 2,000 of the 6,000 people in town.
A third of the town.
One-third of the population, not just the working population, but the entire population, at wages of $18 an hour. 2 years later, wages dropped to $5.60 with no benefit. Imagine the revenue. The last time that things like that happened in the country in the meatpacking industry were back in the days of moonshine in the 1920s. So again, when you take people's traditional revenue sources, they will figure out other ways to make money, whether they are legal or not. So that is something that's similar with meth and with moonshine. There's always a market for booze and drugs. There just is.
Yeah, no doubt. We're talking to Nick Redding, everybody, author of the book Methland. It's a fantastic read, a journalistic read. It's really quite good. Nick, we only have about a minute left, but I got to ask you, what did you get out of writing this book?
You know, oddly, what I got was back home, man. I lived in New York for quite a long time, and I was going back and forth between Iowa and New York. And it just dawned on me how bad I wanted to move back to the Midwest. I mean, people I met were remarkable. I mean, and it seems like kind of a down and out story, but really it's a story about a town that turns itself around. Like, that's what the book to me is about. And I don't know, throughout the course of writing, it just made me miss home. So I picked up in New York and left and came home.
Well, good for you, and I'm glad that you settled back in St. Louis, because it is a great place to grow up and raise children as well. We're talking to Nick Redding, everybody. He's the author of the book Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town, a great nonfiction read. Nick, I'm sorry we're out of time. It has just been a delight. Thank you so much for being my guest on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
Thank you.
Talk to you down the road.
Okay. See you.
All right.